Welcome to the DisList podcast. The DisList podcast is part of the journal Disability and Libraries and Information Studies. I am the host, Jess Schomburg. Today I'll be collecting an oral history from disabled librarian Bree McQueen to hear her stories about working in libraries with disability. Yourself however you would like.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Bree McQueen, and I am a librarian at Miami University regional campuses of Hamilton, Ohio. I use she, her pronouns, and I am a disabled librarian.
Well, welcome. I'm really glad that you are able to talk with me today. I'm really excited to hear your thoughts. We have been in many meetings before, but those don't tend to be focused on personal experiences so much. So
I'm super excited to be here.
Great. So my first question is, before I get to that question, are there any other identities that you want to talk about today or that are fair game to talk about today that impact your work experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think first and foremost, like my racial identity impacts my work experiences and my experiences as a disabled person, I'm a Black woman, body. And so like as a fat Black woman, I think that definitely intersects with my disabilities, how I'm perceived in the workplace and how I can interact in the workplace.
Yep. So, could you tell me, currently work at an academic library. I believe you've also worked in other libraries.
I have, yeah. So I started my library career in public libraries in 2014. I was still an undergraduate student, and I picked up a job at the reference desk at my local public library, fell in love with it, and did about 10 years in public before transitioning to academic in about 8 years before transitioning 2 years ago over to academic libraries, where I am now in my 10th year of working in libraries. So 8 in public, 2 in academic, 10 altogether.
Awesome. Yeah. And you are currently the student success librarian. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah. So I am, like we talked about, the student success librarian, which is a real fun kind of catch-all phrase. It can mean so many different things depending on the institution, the librarian. For me, a lot of that is working with our incoming students who are coming from often a like low socioeconomic background, first generation student, coming from like a historically marginalized community. So I have like a larger influx of Black students, which I'm actually really excited about. I am an alum of this campus. This is where I did my undergraduate, so I'm very excited to be back. And it is much more racially diverse now than it was when I was here from 2010 to 2015. So that's really exciting to see. I partner with our like disability services office, our TRIO offices. And so I'm really here to be first, just a librarian. There's 3 of us. We're a very small campus, so I don't get to like not do the very traditional librarian jobs. I do ordering, reference shifts, things like that. But I also just try and act as a liaison to all these different departments so that when a student's in need, I'm a familiar face and they feel comfortable and safe coming to me. And so much of my job really is relationship building, which is why I'm a little hot and sweaty right now. I taught a class and then was it Fall Fest outside? So it's 88 degrees here. And so a big part of my job is just being present and seen on campus and building those relationships so that when students have research questions or concerns, they're okay being vulnerable with me and saying like, I don't know this. This was not a skill that I had prior to coming to class or to college and things like that.
So you mentioned work with TRIO. I'm going to guess that a lot of people listening to this are not familiar with TRIO. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's fair. And I will be honest, I was not super familiar with it prior to my role, and I apologize in advance if I get any of it wrong, but my understanding is that it is a federally funded program that institutions can take part in through like a grant, essentially, and it really is to provide additional support to students. These are students who, again, are often first-generation students, low economic, have some sort of disability that they've actually registered with the office, because not to like dismiss our students who haven't, but that is the qualification that is registered with our Disability Services Office, qualify for a Pell Grant. So again, that's that low economic status, veteran, things like that. And it really is just like it's support. It is an additional support network for those students. I like to hold office hours. They have their own like lounge on our campus so that they have tutors in there that are designed specifically for them. Additional resources like meals and food for free printing, which is not something the entire campus offers. So those students get it. And so like they're often very comfortable in that space and don't leave it. So I go to them. And so I will hold my office hours there to really like bridge that gap. And make sure that they see me, even if they're not coming to the library, because so few people need books, that it's very easy to not physically come to the library. So I like to go to them.
Yeah, absolutely. So given that you work with students who maybe have similar disability identities or to similar racial identities, how open are you about your disabilities at work?
Fairly open about my disabilities at work. If I'm putting on like the student success part, like hat, I'm very open about like my ADHD. That's something I talk about a lot, especially in my classes as a study skills class. So like this concept of procrastination comes up a lot. And a lot of the curriculums that I'm given, they just really demonize procrastination and or time management skills. And so I work really hard to showcase that there's not one correct way to do time management, to do study skills, that you can find success with a disability. So I'm very open in the classroom about that. There are other disabilities that I'm not quite as vocal about in that space because it just doesn't really feel relevant. In my scholarship, though, I'm very transparent as well. I do disability scholarships, so it becomes very obvious when you read my writings and things like that. I'm pretty open there. I would say in terms of just like general showing up to like council meetings and things like that at the institution at large, I'm a little more quiet there. But in my like two big spaces of like scholarship and in the classroom, I'm pretty loud about it.
So when you say council spaces, what council is that?
So it'd be like if I went to like a faculty forum or like things that involve like all of the large parts of the institution, where I'm very lucky to be in a small library. We are a staff of 5, 3 librarians. We're very close. They know. But like outside of the library, like I feel very small and I don't want necessarily more attention. And so it's not something that I ever feel the need to deny, but not necessarily always bring up. Right. It does happen because I often am the maybe annoying one who is advocating for things that people find challenging. Accommodations don't always seem fun to people who aren't thinking about it all the time. And so often it comes out then, but I'm a pretty low-key, make no waves person otherwise. So I just sit and observe.
Yep. Fair. So we've talked a little bit about your role in supporting students. But what supports have you experienced, either institutionally or personal support structures that have been available to you?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. And I think it varies based on where I have been and what I've needed. I will say that the academic space has been way more safe for me as a disabled person than public libraries were. A large part of that is management, having a manager who I am not afraid to disclose things to, not afraid to say my brain, it's not today. We're not getting there. So having staff members who share identities, who have that like kind of like access intimacy, because we are a very neurodiverse group, has made a huge, huge difference. I also have a form of rheumatoid arthritis, and that can cause a lot of physical discomfort and pain. And so the public library, where you're just constantly on your feet and constantly like going and stuff like that, I was in a fast-paced urban library in Cincinnati. It can physically just be draining and exhausting in a way that I don't feel in a classroom setting. Sometimes I'm going, but it's like 45 minutes to an hour, not 9 to 12 hours.
So was one of your reasons for moving to academia because it sounded, when you were a public librarian, was it because it sounded like it would be more supportive, or was that not really part of your thinking?
No, I wouldn't say it was part of my thinking, but it was maybe. Like, a big part of it was, so I'd finally connected with other disabled librarians through Twitter. And so I was still in public libraries when CripLib kind of started taking off, and I missed research. I missed scholarship. I missed having these discussions. And the truth is that a lot of public librarians do not feel as if they have the time or institutional support to conduct research. It is not a requirement for my job, and they were not going to give us the time for that. Not to mention, we are in the height of COVID. So I worked in public libraries through 2021. And so it was not as if I had any spare time to do. I felt like a lot of my traditional duties as a librarian had been put to the sideline because we were like a vaccine site, a testing site, a meal distribution site. And like, these are all wonderful things, but it just definitely did not leave space for something that wasn't even technically required of my position. There was also physical burnout. Getting COVID multiple times, because we were working with the public very openly without vaccines, I got COVID multiple times, which only worsened the like RA symptoms and other things like that. And so there was some physical burnout as well as just lack of support. It was a very unsupportive place. Especially to not disclose. And so like, there's just the mental burnout of masking and pretending like this was fine.
And you're talking like ADHD masking or disability masking in general?
Yeah, like disability, I would say disability masking. There's definitely ADHD masking, because I was not even formally diagnosed with ADHD or considering that was something I had until maybe later that year that I left. And so that wasn't even, it was just the like pretending that I wasn't in pain after standing on the reference desk for 5 hours. And again, that kind of comes back to these like intersecting identities of like, I know that A, fat people are already perceived as being lazy and less hardworking, so I'm fighting against that, but so are Black people and Black women. And so as a fat Black woman, I felt like I really had to show up in ways that some of my coworkers didn't have to, just to be perceived as on the same playing field as them. And so I felt as if I couldn't say, like, I hurt, and it be read as anything other than my fatness. Or I didn't feel like I could take, like, I need a day off without that being read as anything other than, like, being laziness. Which is how I left the library system with an outrageous number of vacation hours that never got used, because PTO is just not something that I ever did.
So you were doing all of that while still undiagnosed with ADHD, which means not having even the coping skills necessarily?
Yeah, correct.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah. And so we started this conversation in the conversation of like support. And that is why seeing that like call from Katie Manweiler on Twitter, like, I am feeling some things about being disabled in library spaces, was so validating and just, I don't know, there's something very affirming that like it wasn't just me, that yeah, maybe it might be just me in my libraries. And even then, the more I learned, the less I think that's true. But just having like one other person out there that seemed to get it made the difference. And then slowly it's just like we have this like group of people who are like checking in regularly for Twitter chats, and then it evolved into like a Discord group where there, I mean, like, so for support, honestly, the biggest support network that I've had so far as a disabled person has been Cripliv. Having that online space of people who just get it and want to have your back and like want to keep challenging the ideas of what like accessibility and inclusivity looks like in libraries.
So the way I'm hearing the story is like one of the reasons you're still even in the field is because of Cripliv.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Like I was so burnt out, and I mean, I had a very like toxic manager to the point where there were days when I just wanted to quit. If it wasn't like the necessity of paying rent or like insurance, like I'm not sure that I would have stuck around, because as anybody who's ever worked in higher ed knows, like it can be hard and long getting hired into academia, often requiring people to travel and move for jobs. I was trying to apply for things within a 10-hour radius of where I was currently living. And so the fact that I found something 30 minutes away from my home where I went to undergrad is still wild to me and just feels like a blessing from the universe. But I mean, like I had applied to jobs like across like the East Coast, and I was just like, maybe libraries isn't it, because I can't stay. I'm in an area where the libraries, all 40 of them, are run by the same library system, and the system's not working for me right now. Like I was reaching a level of I don't know what to do, but I was not willing to give up my interests in scholarship in the community that we've built. And I just felt like, I don't know, I didn't really want to. There was too much there. It was just a matter of like pushing through. And so that did look like getting a non-librarian position at a different academic library for about a year before my current position like opened up and I could apply for it and stuff like that. But it really was the like kind of break in transition that I needed to recoup from the like burnout that comes with the public library.
Interesting. So would you be okay talking a little bit about maybe your hiring experience with those, with that sort of like transition level from public to your current job?
Yeah. So I think the hardest part was selling myself to an academic library. It is wild how elitist we can still be, even in like the LIS field, between our public librarians and our academic librarians, showing that the skills that I used in my public library were valid and important into an academic space was incredibly hard. Harder than most of like my interactions with the hiring process as a disabled person. Like there were those moments where like long 8-hour Zoom interviews as an ADHD person were brutal. Like they really were. But just selling myself and getting an email back was the hardest part, because so much of public library work can be dismissed in higher ed. And I know this is not the case for everybody, but it was very much the case for me. My public library jobs were always exponentially harder than my experiences have been in. I worked so much harder mentally and physically in public libraries than I have in academic, because you just have so many different hats that you have to wear with so, so little support. And so again, not the universal experience, but that was definitely mine. It was really discouraging to like know how hard I worked, to know how hard I could work, and like just not even get people to look, take me seriously, because I didn't just roll out of grad school into a high, like an academic position.
You were circle shape and they're like squares only. Mm-hmm. Only squares.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so I think a big part of the reason that I was able to make some of this transition was I was not hired as a librarian. They were looking for a manager. So I came in as a manager. I did not come out as a librarian. And I got to flex a lot of my librarian skills. And they eventually increased my pay because they realized they were utilizing me as a librarian. But my first position in higher ed was not as a librarian.
So you came in at a manager level because you were good enough to be a manager, but not good enough to be a librarian. And then you had to prove yourself as a librarian, even though you'd spent 8 years being a librarian before they would take that seriously.
Yeah. And so again, I will say both of the managers that I had, because it was at two different institutions, phenomenal, like so great. But like in the whole, like, I mean, I think over the course of like 18 months, I had applied to very close to like 200 different places. And the level of responses that you get, it just shows how little they value public library workers trying to transition into higher ed. I was a teen librarian, so honestly, not even that different of an age group, especially because I work with a lot of like college prep, like the college credit plus students, so like high schoolers who are coming and taking classes. Like a lot of my students are actually still 16, 17 right now. So my age demographic has not changed. And so it's really interesting how hard that part was. And so then I would say like tying this to disability, like it was defeating. It increased anxiety. I already struggled to focus, but the additional stress made like my ADHD worse. Stress will make your arthritis worse. Like my joints are hurting. Like it was very, very stressful. And it made you just feel not wanted in the field a little bit.
Yeah, I believe that. Yeah. But your current job, like you have it, you have a good manager.
I do.
Supportive.
Mm-hmm.
And you've sort of mentioned being able to say to your current managers, like, bad day, bad brain day, bad whatever day, stuff isn't going to work. So ask this question. Not because it's a bad question, just because I'm not sure how to phrase it. But so does this mean that you have been able to sort of informally accommodate yourself in discussion with your supervisor, or have you gone through a formal accommodation process?
Absolutely. We definitely work in a more informal capacity. And so I think some of them are as simple as just patience with one another when we know that this is not going to be the day. There have been days where we come in and somebody's like, I cannot sit down for a staff meeting. I'm like, okay, there we go. That was it. That's the accommodation. We're not doing it. We'll do it another day when we can sit down and like, we have like collectively the ability to like have these conversations and focus and do things. There have been things as simple as like, I'm needing like special headphones or like earplugs to focus and stuff like that have just, we've just worked through it as a department. So I do feel like a lot of that has been just handled in informal ways or needing like an occasional work from home day. We don't really have a true work from home policy because we are small. We need bodies in the building to keep it open. So it doesn't really give us the option to have a lot of them. But if I was to text tomorrow and say, it's not it. I really just need to work from home. We'd make that happen. So that's been really nice to know that I have somebody who's willing to work with me to the extent that she can and who would have my back if I needed to go through a more formal process. It's not something that I've ever really done. And I feel like because of the work I do, I should be more confident trying to go through it. But like, it's exhausting. It's so much. It's so much. And even doing this kind of work, I'm not sure that I would even fully know where to start and what rights and protections I have. Like the process is purposefully confusing, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my perception as well. And I also have dipped my toe in the waters and then taken my toes right back out.
Yeah.
Yep. So, I think I'm going to sort of switch the focus a little bit, but also feel free to say like that you want to talk more about what we've already talked about.
Yeah.
But I think I'm going to switch the focus of this to maybe more of your advocacy work.
Yeah, cool.
Because you've mentioned CRIPLIB, you've mentioned research you've done in this area. I know you've given presentations in this area. So could you talk a little bit more about how you started to get involved in publicly speaking out, either like in a written form or spoken form or any other form, to publicly speak out, to advocate for people with disability?
Yeah, it feels like a little broken recordy, but it really was Twitter. Like that's where it started. It was as simple as seeing someone put a call out, like, would anybody be interested in talking about this? And so just started with chatting, moderating monthly chats with questions to kind of encourage people to start sharing their experiences. And it's when I think I realized how important the work was, because I started to see myself and started to identify as an actual disabled person, because prior to that, I don't know that I did. I did not see my anxiety as a disability. I did not even know I had ADHD yet. So I definitely did not consider that as a disability. And having visible representation of what disability could look like changed how I understood myself and how I interacted with libraries. And so if I found it that meaningful to me, like, it had to be me. There was no way that it wasn't going to be meaningful for other people to have those same kind of moments of recognition. And I think the more that I started talking about it and meeting other librarians who felt the way that I did but didn't know what to do with it, it only motivated me more to like be loud, because I am naturally a very non-confrontational person unless I'm advocating on behalf of someone else. And then I just like get this fire underneath me. And so I often, when I give like these talks or when I was still on Twitter and would have, it was just really that like need to support and protect others, because I think it's what was missing for me when I was coming up through LIS. Especially as like, I mean, I remember like almost all of my classes being like the only Black librarian, or I worked in a very large library system, was like one of a few Black people and almost always only the Black like librarian. And so it was just, I don't know, it was just like seeing how important representation was and just needing to give that to other people, because I knew I needed it when I was younger.
So that, yeah, I think a lot about students who, I'm sure your school has this too, where it's like, we're trying to close equity gaps between white students and students of color. And so often the conversations are, how do we change these students? And it's like, well, changing yourself enough that they don't have to come in and be the only.
Yeah,
it's just so isolating. And you listening to you talk about like how knowing you're not the only person with disability, knowing you're not the only person with ADHD in libraries, like that kind of kept you around and kept you moving forward in a way that maybe you wouldn't have if you had continued to feel so isolated. And yeah, it's just,
yeah, I'm so confident that we would not be sitting here having this conversation today, and that I would not be a librarian today had I not found community. I mean, that is why I'm here. That's why I stayed in the field. It's not the money. I mean, so it's because I enjoy the work and I found an amazing community. And I don't know, I think it's important. And I sometimes feel like a broken record or like I'm too loud and I say the same things over and over again. But like just today, I was in class talking about growth, like a growth mindset and setting goals where it's okay to fail. It's okay to make mistakes. And I mentioned yet again, like how much I struggle with time management and how like I don't always feel like a really eloquent speaker because there's so much happening in my mind at once that I'll like trip over my own words and that it can be like make me feel self-conscious when I have to give presentations. So like, so students shouldn't get discouraged about that. And just, I repeat myself over and over again, but at the end of the day, a student came up to me, he's like, what do you do if you think you have ADHD? Like some of the things that you're saying, I feel like, what do I do with this? And so I'm loud and annoying about it because I know that there is somebody listening who needs to hear it. And that's how we can like make a difference, is to like get those resources and like into like their hands. Because for me, it was Instagram, which for better or worse, as like an information professional, I don't know how I feel about some of the way information is spreading right now, but I do think it's great to be able to get information so easily. And so all of a sudden I just got an influx of like ADHD content and I was like, wow, this like actually really, really tracks, especially the way that it presents, like, and people identified as female at birth, people of color and stuff like that. And like the way that I was a high performing student with a lot of anxiety and it just got very overlooked. And so it is that like constant representation that even gave me the confidence to like have a conversation with a doctor, or gave a student confidence to have a conversation with me.
Relatable. Yeah, that's it wasn't Instagram, but some combination of Twitter and Tumblr is definitely like how I was like, oh, that's what's going on with my brain. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe related to this and related to, because you mentioned feeling a little bit weird as a librarian, like this is how people are getting their information. Mm-hmm. So what do you think in terms of disability in general, or any particular combination of your disabilities and identities, like what do you think is like one of the more problematic misconceptions or bits of misinformation out there that you've seen?
I think for me, there's something about, there's something very gatekeepy about diagnoses that I think I see a lot of on, or maybe it's not even that I see in so much like the like Instagram reels, or I'm very TikTok avoidant, not because there's anything wrong with TikTok. I just cannot give myself another app to scroll. So I get everything later when it comes to Instagram. But like maybe more in the comments and the actual content, that people are really, really resistant to the idea that people know their bodies, their brains, their identities, more than a test might, or that a medical professional might, and that in order to be validated as a disabled person, you have to meet these kind of like standards. And I think that's really damning and dangerous. And I think maybe the biggest problem with social media is that everything can spread so quickly like a wildfire and not get checked. And so then that kind of perception just can like run rampant. And so I think that's one of my biggest concerns, especially because for the longest time it was like I sat in this limbo space of, okay, I know I had anxiety. Like I was formally diagnosed at a very young age, like hospitalized because of how severe my anxiety was at a very young age, but didn't feel disabled enough. So I sat in that space of not disabled enough. And so if we spread this idea that if you don't check the boxes, if you didn't go formally to the doctor and get the diagnosis, that you're not disabled enough. And I think that's really dangerous.
That again, once again, what you're saying is like super relatable. I also have spent quite a bit of time in that. I'm not disabled enough. I don't quite count. And it's like,
And I think a lot of people feel that way, especially a lot of people with like invisible disabilities. There is this idea of not performing your disability enough, or not being read as disabled enough, or just not even being disabled enough to take, because we treat accommodations as if it's a finite source. And so it's like, oh, I'm not disabled enough to take that from somebody else. Somebody else might actually need it. And I'm like, well, no, if we just did things in a way that's inclusive, like there'd be enough for me and you. Like I shouldn't have to justify my level of disability to just be accommodated. And so I think that's one of the things that I still struggle with, personally, like not feeling like I should take up space or resources because there's somebody who might need it more than me. And I think that can be perpetuated when we gatekeep who gets to be or identify as disabled.
So with that in mind, I mean, I can kind of guess at what your answers might be, but with that in mind, how would you want to change either the political systems, various systems around disability broadly, or specifically around like accommodations? Like, what would you like to see?
I think for the accommodations, I'm going to be honest, I'm going to stick with accommodations because right now politically just feels so unwieldy. I wouldn't know where to start. But for accommodations, I would love for it to just be as simple as people believing disabled people, that the barriers of having to get all of this like documentation, medical appointments, things like that is such a barrier in itself and so like debilitating to somebody's success, because it is wholly dependent on things like insurance, money, time, transportation to these appointments, the like cognitive load and like ability to even like process all of the steps that I would have to take to get an ADHD accommodation as somebody who gets overwhelmed by so many steps. Like that in itself is a problem. I need an accommodation for my accommodation program. Like, and so it needs to just be more of a conversation between like employer, employee, or student and teacher of like, this is where I'm at. Where can we meet? What can, like, how can we move forward? And I mean, you're always going to have bad actors in a situation. So like, I understand the need for like some kind of like formalized process, but I don't think it needs to be quite as bureaucratic and prohibitive as it currently is. I don't think we have this situation of like people not wanting to work or not wanting to work at the level which they're supposed to. And that's why they're going up for accommodations and things. Like I think we often approach the accommodation process institutionally from a very like bad faith perspective, instead of like looking at all the potential that could happen if we met people where they were.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So kind of switching slightly in terms of topics, but I mean, similar, but anyway, so since you publicly acknowledge that you have a disability, how does it affect your advocacy for others?
Yeah, I think so. Because I am public about most of my disabled identities, I think it allows me to feel comfortable being loud and advocating for others. It also, I think, gives me, I don't know. I feel like this doesn't relate, but it does. But it gives me space to be curious. And like, I've learned so much about disability. Like, it's very much like being disabled does not make me an expert on disability or disability scholarship, just in the way that like being Black doesn't make me an expert on like critical race theory and things like that. But it has made me curious, and it has given me space to learn more about my own disabilities, how we interact with disability as like a field. I have thoughts that could be an entire interview in itself about, I mean, we are an information field. So the way that we often interact with people and discuss like things around like cognitive disabilities and stuff like that can get really scary, really very elitist. There, I mean, we've rarely talked about class, but like we could really have that kind of conversation too. I love information, but it comes with dangerous territories in higher ed. Higher ed can be very ableist in a lot of ways. And it's really interesting for me as somebody who is kind of forced to operate within a certain structure. You know, we want to keep our jobs, but my beliefs don't necessarily align with them. Like I don't write very academically. I want my writing to be accessible, and that has continuously been a problem. And I've been told that I write too colloquially, that it's not professional enough, that it's not this enough. And I'm like, but that's not, I'm not really writing for the institution. And so it is something I feel like I'm like veering around, but coming back is like, I'm in a space where I want to write about these things and I want to talk about these things in a way that matter to other people and that are accessible to other people, because that's who I care about, is like the people. There are other people who are doing the like change institution work, and that's great, and that's what they're good at. But I'm at the like representation, talk with people, support and advocate for people. I'm a very people-y person. It's why I was never good in the back end jobs of libraries. Like, I want to be on the forefront talking to people. I don't want to be doing the policy work. I don't want to be doing the cataloging. Like, I'm not good at those things. I'm good at being social. I'm good at having like at like more front-facing advocacy work and talking and giving people the information that they need to feel empowered to learn about themselves and advocate for themselves. Or even if, and even maybe like learning and advocating is just creating space to find community. And things like that. And so, yeah, I think I got a little tangenty and whirlwind, but hopefully that's coherent in the end for people.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. I, as a former cataloger who, I don't want to say that like writing policy statements is my safety blanket, but it kind of is, because it's like so easy for me. Like, not to say that I'm an expert or like the Marvel's person, but it's like not stressful for me to do that kind of work. Whereas like, I really appreciate other people who are like going out to talk with strangers and being excited and energetic and charismatic. It's like, yeah, I'm so glad that you're doing what you do so I can do what I'm more comfortable with.
Yeah. And I love that. And I mean, I've had the opportunity to work on like those kinds of things with you and stuff like that. And it is, I don't know, I think that's like the beauty of like working with CripLib and like with other disabled people, is like really just being comfortable honing in on what we're good at and not feeling stressed to take on what we're not good at. I'm really good at just talking to people. And like, it doesn't give me anxiety. Like it's something that I'm fine with. I can do small talk. I can go talk to, and you know, and I'm going to embrace that. But having to sit down and write a formal document, I'm going to sweat. And so if somebody else is going to offer to take that, I will go stand at the fall fest in 88 degree weather and like talk to students and be loud. And if that eases the anxiety for somebody who doesn't feel comfortable doing that. And I love that there are people who I get to interact with who will take the anxiety of formal writing off my plate. But I think one of the things I really do love about like a lot of disabled community is like that willingness to admit what you're able to do, and then the acceptance from other people that that's what this person can handle, and I'm going to pick up what I can handle, and like we just kind of make it work. It's that collective care, and just really like communicating needs and like accepting where each person is coming from and what they can bring to the table.
So is this part of the reason you find the higher ed focus on ideals of cognitive performance so unsatisfying?
Yes, because I do not think, there's just this like perception of like intelligence and IQ that in itself is disgusting, and so there's that. But like just thinking about like the ways in which I have been told so many times that I couldn't do something because I do not perform my intelligence or my academic writing. And I mean, from a very young age, I've always been a huge reader, loved English classes, right out the gate told that I was not cut out for like a college prep English class or an AP English class. And like, because my writing wasn't strong enough, it wasn't academic enough, I have these like run-on sentences and I hate grammar and have big thoughts about grammar policing. I never performed my intelligence in the way that people wanted me to. And I doubted my intelligence for a very long time. And so flash forward to now, again, I feel weird using the word intelligence because it can be misread in a lot of ways, but for simplicity's sake, I will keep it. I'm very confident in what I know and what I'm good at, but it's still at times, because of where I sit in higher ed and the way I have to publish and do scholarship, the work that I put out often feels disingenuous because it doesn't sound like me and it's not actually what I wanted to do because I want my writing to be accessible. I've been doing a lot of work with two other scholars around crip time and what time looks like as disabled people. And I think it's so fascinating, but there are so many sentences that I just feel like I have used the most pretentious and annoying language to meet the like standards of like writing for higher ed. And I roll my eyes reading my own stuff now. And like, it just, I don't know, it, I want my work to be accessible and continue to be accessible. And I really struggle to find that balance of meeting the expectations of what intellect and like academic production looks like and the meaning of the words I'm putting out there. So like, I find that hard to meet their standards and my values.
Yeah, I was when you mentioned that you've been discouraged from pursuing literary studies sort of at an academic level, I was like, but why? Because I like, you and I have talked about books before because we're both readers, and you approach books with such curiosity and such enthusiasm, and your ability to like, honestly, your ability to just like get through stuff that I'm like, no, I'm that's not for me. But yeah, it just, because you're so insightful and you're so curious and you're so all of the things that we're told that higher education should be supporting. But just because you can't.
That final production didn't look the way that they wanted it. And so
once again, you wear a circle and they only accept squares.
Yeah. And it's funny. I really do. I look back and I realize like that middle school and high school teachers who told me no, I couldn't do it, was why for 3 years in undergrad I was not an English major. For 3 years I was in a different program because I already knew I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that thing I wanted. And it wasn't until I had a professor who was like, you're in my class every semester. What are you doing? You're not an English major. Are you just gonna like own up to the fact that you're actually an English major? Like, are you even taking education classes? Like, you're an ed major. Why are you here in every one of my classes? And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. And so it wasn't until my third year that I ended up changing my major, and I did English Lit. And I ended up just double majoring. And I also did women's studies because this faculty member did a lot of their courses were cross-listed. And so all of a sudden, having, you know, conversations about like queer theory, critical race theory. They taught some disability scholarship and stuff like that. I took a disability theory class, and that was kind of like, I would say that's like where I first dipped my toe. And I was like, oh, interesting. this scratches something. I was late to the party in my own major because I think I was just already set up to believe that like I was not academically good enough for something because I didn't produce scholarship or do my homework in a certain way, and like I didn't meet these very rigid standards of what and how we judge intellect and scholarship or intelligence. And so, yeah.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our scheduled time. So I have two more questions for you. And if there's anything that I've skipped that you would like to talk about, I'll ask one of my last two questions and then leave time for you to just sort of talk if you would like to.
Okay.
But my last formal question is, what is unique about library workers as people with disability?
Ooh. I think I think something that I've noticed about library workers is a level of curiosity and interest that I'm not used to seeing maybe in other. I mean, we're here, most of us are here because we do like learning in some way or another. We like research. We like even like when I wasn't like working in research, like as a public librarian, like my favorite thing was when a patron would come in and just ask me the most out of left field question. And this was now my opportunity to like just be curious and pretend to be an expert about something for like 15 minutes and just like completely nerd out and dig and dive. And there is a level of curiosity that I think comes with the profession in general. But then when you add in disability, there's a different level of curiosity. Cause like now this curiosity is like, how can I make a space mine that wasn't meant for me? Like there's this extra little bit of like DIYing your way through the field and like interactions and like managing your self almost, like, you know, like caring for yourself and caring for your interests and your protecting your it's such a cliche saying, but like protecting your peace, like being able to just walk out at the end of the day and like not feel defeated. I think there's just like this really interesting level of curiosity and creativity. That's a big one. Very creative. I don't know. I'm sure people in other professions feel the same way, but my experience is so library centered. I started in libraries before I even graduated from undergrad. And there is just, I don't know, there is a level of creativity, I think, that just comes, curiosity and creativity, that is very unique to LAIS, because so many of us get to be researchers and experts in like so many different areas because we're helping faculty with cool projects or students or patrons who just really want to know about something that day. And I don't know, it's really cool. And it's also like really inspiring. I've been told for so long that I couldn't do things. I'm talking to my students the other day, and I'm like, you know, if I could go back and get a new degree, like an undergrad, I think I would want to do botany. Like I was never good at like sciences, but the more time I get to talk to people and research things and do little, like I'm so interested, like, and it just makes me feel like there's so much more potential when there's space to be creative and curious.
Yeah. What are those things called where you take a clip and advertise with it?
Oh, like a soundbite?
Yeah. Yeah. So is there anything else that we haven't talked about today that you want to make sure that you have a little time and space for?
No, not particularly. Like, I thought this was a really good conversation. I think I would just encourage, like, I don't know, anybody who listens to this and stuff like that, to like just keep reading or keep listening, keep exploring disabled stories. If you are not a disabled person or don't identify as disabled, and for people who do identify as disabled who are listening to this and stuff like that, like, I hope that you can like continue to find community and support in the field, because it is hard. And I feel like overwhelmingly, like the conversation that we had today has been really positive, which I love, but like there have been some really, really hard times. And like, I was candid about probably not being here, but I mean, like there were days when I like physically didn't think my body could any longer. And so like, it's not all positive. Like, it's really hard. And so, like, I hope that, like, having things like oral histories and, like, just getting to talk to more people and, like, allows librarians who might feel alone to, like, see that they're not and give them opportunities to reach out. Or I don't know. Like, I think it's, I love that it feels like we're talking about this more, but I'm also very much, like, in this sphere. And so, like, I hope that, like, librarians who are disabled but maybe don't do disability scholarship also, like, feel the support that, like, we who do this kind of work feel working with one another.
Yeah. So last up is JJ suggested I add a fun question.
Ooh, okay.
Because I'm not fun. I'm not the fun person at the party. So thank you, JJ, for suggesting this. What are you excited to be reading right now?
So honestly, I would love to be excited to be reading. I have been in the worst reading slump, but it is, it's like we're rolling into like spooky season. And so Rachel Harrison just released a new book maybe yesterday, So Thirsty, and this is her take on a vampire novel, and I'm very, very excited for it. So I think that's the big thing that I'm looking forward to reading. I'm hopeful that my brain will focus on words on a page. So
good luck with that.
Yeah, that'll be it. But I'm excited for just like cozy weather and scary books.
Thank you all for listening to the Dislist podcast. This is one of the first in an ongoing series of oral histories. I was delighted to have the opportunity to talk with Bree and learn more about how she builds community in library spaces. Show notes with links to more information about some of the ideas we talked about are provided on the Dislist Journal website, along with a transcript of this recording.